Okay, so a few more people are here, so that's good. Again, we're studying from Daniel. We're in the seventh chapter, beginning with verse 15, when we actually start talking about tonight's lesson. But just some thoughts. We're entering a new section of Daniel. What was the style? That 7 through 12, chapter 7 through 12 is written in. You remember what I told you? It's apocalyptic. So what does the word apocalyptic mean? Revealed or revelation. Is there other books in the Bible that's written in this apocalyptic style? In the New Testament, Revelation jumps up to mind. But in the Old Testament, Ezekiel and parts of Jeremiah are also written in there. So it's a means of revealing normally something futuristic in a way that you can kind of relate to it if you understand what the symbols are. So... Chapter 7 says that it's the first year of Belshazzar. Since the kingdom of Babylon ended in the sixth chapter, so he's jumped back in time. What's the year that the Babylonian Empire ended? 539 B.C. What year of Belshazzar approximately was that? That was about his third year, most probably. So if it was his third year, about what time frame is the first year? 542 B.C. So we jump back in time so that Daniel can explain something that's had been very perplexing to him. And what he explained was a vision that he saw. So, what did he see? Where was he? He was asleep on his bed, and he's having a dream. In the next chapter, it'll really be a vision. He'll be in a different place. But what did he see that was so disturbing? Four beasts coming out of the sea, and if you look and see how the sea is described, it's kind of the scene of creation. That's not what's being depicted, but I mean being talked about, but it's that kind of thing. The water is churning in four different directions at once. So that's not orderly. What would we call that? It's very chaotic. And then out of this turmoil, he sees beasts come up. Are these normal beasts? The first three are close to normal. They just got some modifications to them. The fourth one you might call hybrid. In fact, in our terminology, we might want to call it robotic, except that it's not robotic. It wasn't a real animal per se. What were the first three beasts that he saw? He saw a lion, a bear, and a jaguar. And each one of these animals has characteristics that are important to what they're going to be described by. Daniel doesn't understand what they are, and as we get into tonight's lesson, who is going to tell Daniel what they mean? An angel, basically. An angel is standing there among a large group that he's seeing in this dream. Daniel is very perplexed by this. Not as much as he will be in chapter 8 by what he sees, but very perplexed. And so he asks what they mean, the first three. And then he goes on to ask specifically, what does this fourth one mean? And so we realize that what he's being shown, futuristic events mostly, starting with the present time, and what do these animals represent? Four kingdoms, and this will be made clear in chapter 8 when God takes a different approach at this same message several years in the future from where we are right now, 3 years to be exact, and he's going to have Gabriel explain it to him, and Gabriel pinpoints what those three kingdoms are. So anyway, in this chapter, the angel is not going to identify which kingdoms they are. There's through history been a lot of discussions about this. When you put it with chapter 8, you see what three of them are. Is it important what these nations are specifically? What is the underlying message that God is trying to get across to Daniel, basically, so that Daniel can, in the future, lead this message? What's God trying to say? Well, where are his chosen people right at the moment? They're still in captivity. Babylon took Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire, took them prisoner some 70 years earlier. 70 years minus 3 here, because the full 70 hasn't happened yet. It will in chapter 8. By chapter 8 it will have happened, and in chapter 9 Daniel says, aha, I remember, and he'll start a prayer. But basically 70 years almost at least have transpired. During this time they were not living in their promised land. They were taken captive. They were ruled by a nation that had continuously been in turmoil. The last few years of Nebuchadnezzar's life were like what? And it reflected the kingdom. What happened to him? He became an animal for 7 years, basically, until he was willing to identify that the power that he had seen and his great empire, he had nothing to do with raising it to that point. He was God's vehicle. Once he acknowledged that, he got it all back. And then he died of natural causes, but he died a few years later. And there was other kings. And now the last king of Babylon is Belshazzar, who had his own vision. We studied about that in previous chapter. And now Daniel is identifying that 3 years before that incident, he started having some visions of his own. God was trying to give him a message as well. And the underlying message here is really, if you don't try to specifically identify which nations these are, I mean, from chapter 8 on, we'll have a good idea who they are. But that's not what's important. The message is, nations of the earth, evil in nature, are going to continuously rise up and be destroyed, and be raised up and destroyed. And this is going to go on for how long? In chapter 8, Gabriel makes it clear to the end. What's not necessarily clear to us today, at least in the minds of some, is what end is he talking about? Is he talking about the absolute end of time? And I hold that view and can tie Revelation and its time frame and all of that into that. But there are others who have valid arguments that the end of time is really the end of age, and the end of age they're talking about is the end of the Jewish age and the establishment of the church. The problem I have with that is not that that's not true, but these revelations, whether it be Revelations, whether it be in Ezekiel, or whether it be in Daniel, talks about some events that haven't happened in our lifetime yet. So there's a gap in that kind of thinking. We know that Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, has been fulfilled. The kingdom was established in the first century. But One of the things that Daniel sees in this chapter is this kingdom that's going to last forever gets handed off to him. It gets handed off to not Christ. Christ has it. Who's in it? It goes back to God. Now, in the New Testament, we read of that also. Christ, it was said that Christ said in more than one place, and his apostles say it also, that when is the nation going to be handed off? What has to happen first? See, right now, Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. The nation, the new kingdom, will go back to God when? There was a condition. Right, exactly. Has that happened yet? No. All you got to do is look at the world out here that we're living in, you see. And that's the big issue that I have with trying to terminate this process with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. It is, there's a part of this that discusses that, but there's these events that go much further than that. And some of them haven't happened yet. And they're important to us because, that being said, what's the message then? Why would God want to bring this up? If he is fighting a cosmic battle, which we know between good and evil is taking place, whether it be eternally in ourselves or whether it be heavenly, a battle is definitely going on. So, that being said, what would the important message be? Especially to his captive people at this time. Hope. Revelation 2:10. Does anybody know what the last half of that verse says? Christ is talking to the church at Smyrna, one of the seven churches of Asia that he writes to in the first three books, the first three chapters of that book. In chapter 2:10, the last half of the verse, what does Christ say? Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. And that's certainly the message here. He's showing Daniel that a battle is taking place, but not to fear, because who's going to hold the victory when it's all said and done? He is. God is. And the kingdom will be returned to him. And what's the state of that kingdom? It's an everlasting kingdom. And what has to happen for that to take place? Well, we'll look at what the angel says, but some things have to happen in terms of these beasts and their destruction, these kingdoms and their destruction, and Revelation talks about the same thing. Yes, Scott. Pretty good, actually. I would say for Daniel, they were excellent. What position does he hold? He's second or third in the kingdom in terms of authority. Later, 100 years or so, Esther is going to hold a similar, it's more like 50, but Esther's going to hold a similar position. She'll be queen. But you remember in the book of Jeremiah, after the captivity had taken place, Jerusalem had been destroyed, the captives had gone, all of them. Remember, it happened in three waves over a three-year period. Finally, they're all in Babylon. God sent a letter to them. He had a letter drafted and was sent to them. And we talked about basically what was the message at that time. What did that letter say if you boiled it all down and summarized it? You're not coming home in 2.5 years like the false prophets are telling you. You're going to be here a while. How long? They're going to be there 70 years. So you're going to be here. What does he say? Basically, put down roots. Give your daughters in marriage. Find wives for your sons. Buy, sell, live your lives, and pray for the prosperity of the city that you find yourself in. Why? Why would you want your enemies to prosper? They Exactly. You're going to be here a long time, probably your whole life for most of these. Remember, they were there 70 years. Daniel was one of the few that's still alive and can remember. But is Daniel a young man now? No, he's at least 87 years old. Could be older depending on how old he actually was, 17 or 20, when he was taken captive. So most of them weren't alive. Those were all new generations of Jews. So if you're living, if you're prosperous where you're living, if your city's prosperous, you're going to be prosperous. So you ask, what's the living conditions of these people? They were pretty good. They could travel throughout the kingdom. Daniel was able to go from one nation to the next. All of them couldn't. They were, most of them, confined in the area of Iraq. Some of them, towards the end, had found themselves in what we call Iran. And Daniel was able to pretty much diplomatically go wherever he wanted to in the empire. In fact, chapter 8, we're going to see he's not in Babylon. He is in Iran, at one of the capital cities there of that time, Susa, to be exact. So their living conditions were pretty good. God wasn't trying to destroy them by sending them into captivity. They had been worshiping idols, and he wanted to make a point. I'll put you somewhere where you're going to be forced to do that. If you don't listen to me, I'll put you over there. Learn a lesson. Learn repentance. And it worked. And more than likely because of the efforts of Daniel, and we're going to see that before this book ends, that he's going to pray on behalf of his nation. When a little light bulb goes on and he realizes, hey, 70 years has passed, according to Jeremiah. So, how much longer, God? And so he fasts and he prays, and God sends him a messenger again. So, an angel will be sent to him to talk to him about this very thing. So, not to get off of the lesson, but nations are going to come and nations are going to go. You're going to be oppressed. And in some cases, you're going to be free. Maintain hope. Be faithful to death, and the promise is a crown of life. And that's been the message from this point. We'll be all the way through the first century. It's a message to us. We think about that all the time. We don't get oppressed like some of these people do, but we wage an internal battle against evil all the time. And sometimes outside influences tend to make it even worse. Sometimes we even drift away from the church. And it can really get bad. But remember, there's a way, and God says, hold on. Remember, the victory's going to ultimately be mine. Be faithful to that. Hold on to that, and you'll be rewarded. And that's a promise we can take to the bank, basically. And so now we're pretty much here. The last part of the vision that he saw, he sees a gentleman being described. Two of them, actually. One of them was described as white. He was wearing bright white clothes. Pure white hair. And he had a name. What was your name? The Ancient of Days. He was identified, obviously, as a judge. He was sitting on a throne as a judge. And it says there were books at his, there were books at his feet. And these kingdoms are going to be just, first off, who's the Ancient of Days? Does anybody have any doubt that it's the Ancient of Days? It is God. In the same vision, there's another individual seen riding on a cloud, and we talked about that last week. Whether it be in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, who is the cloud rider? Jesus Christ is the cloud rider. Remember when the law was given at Mount Sinai? The presence of God descended on a cloud. That same messenger spoke at Mount Sinai, at the burning bush with Moses before all of that. Whenever God was present in the tabernacle, what happened? A cloud descended. Where did it stay? It stayed in the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies, and specifically on top of the ark between the two cherubim. But where else did that cloud appear? 40 years they wandered in the wilderness. What led them in the daytime? A cloud. What led them at night was a pillar of fire. When Christ ascended to heaven, how did he ascend? On a cloud. Does anybody have any doubt that Christ is the cloud walker, rider? No. Because we already see one of the Godhead here as the judge. Who does Christ say is going to judge at the end? Who is the ultimate judge? God. So there can be no doubt that the Ancient of Days is God. And the individual who is given the kingdom is this individual that rides this cloud chariot. But it's going to show that this kingdom is going to be given back to God. And we know that from the New Testament as well. So, talking about God, talking about Christ, talking about the Godhead is what's being talked about. So, if there's no further questions, let's actually, in the time left, what I want to do is read, if I can, the whole rest of this chapter, verse 15 through 28, and then we'll go back and look at the two parts of the angel's interpretation to Daniel. Remember, Daniel, after seeing all of this and seeing all these people that are there in this heavenly realm, these four beasts, and specifically the one that is speaking boisterous words against the Ancient of Days and the other individual who's riding on the cloud, you kind of want to wonder who these are. Daniel is extremely perplexed in the next chapter, 3 years later, when he sees a similar vision with even more clarity. He is pale, he says, and during the first part of it, he's going to be laid out prostrate, he says, with his head to the ground. He's sick after what he sees. And he's given some instructions at the end of this chapter, and he'll be given some more at the end of that interpretation in chapter 8. So let's begin with Daniel 7, verse 15. Yes? Oh, that's all right. Right. It doesn't have the form of an animal. But what it does have is, it's said to have iron teeth and bronze claws. What do you think those teeth and claws mean? If that were a real animal, why would it have those? To tear into its prey, to devour its prey. In this message, who is the prey of this animal? Well, according to Daniel and what he's seeing, it is the people of God, the people of the Most High, this Ancient of Days. So, what we're not told in this is, these saints, are they human, or are they angelic, or are they both? That's not revealed yet, and won't be even completely revealed in chapter 8. But I'll ask you, is that important to the underlying message? No. Because in reality, while there is a battle going on in heaven, we know we're living in a battle going on here on earth. I think, as some scholars do, it's a little bit of both that's being described here. God has people here on earth, certainly. And he also has angels, two different classes of beings, basically, but they all belong to God. So this force, whatever it is, because it's not revealed yet what this is devouring these people, whoever they are. Later it'll become clearer, perhaps, who this is. Does anybody have an idea what nation Because the angel says it's a nation. What nation he might be, these symbologies might be describing. I'm with Cal. I believe it's Rome also. And we'll discuss that more when we deal with chapter 8. Because right now, with these nations not being identified, there's two different ways you can break them down. And one stops at Rome, and one stops with in the 2nd century B.C. with Antiochus the 4th of Epiphanes. So it's clear to me when you put these two chapters together that the futuristic description is further than just the 2nd century. For one thing, when does the eternal kingdom become established in either one of these dreams? Looking at it from our vantage point, that's fulfilled in the 1st century. Not the 2nd century B.C., but the 1st century, A.D., when Christ came. So that's very important, and keep that in mind. When the angel says these are going to happen in the distant future, he means that. If you look at, that's why the time frame we're talking about here is important. If this is 542 and then later 539, and we're looking at something that's going to take place in the first century, that's 542 years, 539 years out. But that's only part of what happens there. And there's not a time frame put on how far beyond that. But in both of these, you see that there's something that, and we know by looking around, that hasn't happened yet. And it comes from this message, and comes from the one in Revelation. So it's important to keep these time frames involved. In chapter 8, the angel's going to tell us who three of these kings are. So that pretty well, to me, clarifies of the two ways of breaking them down, which ones they are. And so it only leaves that fourth one. Do you stop it in the middle of the 2nd century B.C., or is it a power that goes on beyond the 1st century? And it'll become clearer, I think, as to who that is. So let's start with verse 15. I, Daniel, remember, he's seen all of this, and he doesn't understand. Would you understand the meaning of this if you just saw this vision? No. You obviously would realize that, remember, in looking down in that chaos, what's he looking in? The abyss, basically. And he sees these nations coming out of it, but then we're at the throne room of God in part of the description. When the throne is put out there and the Ancient of Days is sitting there and there's books at his feet and he's going to act as a judge, that really sounds like the end. In fact, the angel's going to refer to it as the end. That's his terminology. It's just, what end is he talking about? But the thing of it is Daniel is looking there. So he's looking at the two extremes, and he's seeing this, and he's seeing that obviously there's a message, but what is it? This vision is enough to scare anyone to death, especially if you realize that these beasts are kingdoms. He probably felt that, but does it affect me now? Is it going to affect somebody in the future? What is this? Well, he didn't know. But he says, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. So remember, he's up there, and he's in that throne room, and he sees this large number of people. And so now he's going to approach one of them and ask them questions. In the next chapter, we'll see that for sure that God dispatches an angel to him. The name is Gabriel. And then in the next chapter and the next chapter, he'll dispatch him again to talk to Daniel with interpretation. But right now, he says, I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all of this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts, which are four kings, which rise out of the earth. But the saints, the saints of the Most High. Here are the people that Daniel saw. The angel, I believe this is an angel, this individual is calling them saints. So what he doesn't tell him is what the saints are. From our vantage point in history, it resonates with us that these are the saints. Who do we refer to as saints in the New Testament era? Christians who've gone on before. But we're not in the first century era right now, not actually. So who are these saints? Could they be a host of angels? Certainly they could. Could they be the patriarchs who've died before? Certainly they could. And who knows how many other people throughout Jewish history who've kept the faith. But we're not told. All that's stated here, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So, the kingdom belongs to the Ancient of Days, or belongs to God. From our vantage point in history, we know that the fulfillment of that part of the prophecy took place in the first century. Isaiah prophesied it, Jeremiah prophesied it, others in the Old Testament prophesied that at some point in history, God was going to establish a kingdom that was going to last forever, and his messenger was going to be king. And in the New Testament, all of that is linked together, and we're told that it's Christ. And who is the kingdom? What is the kingdom? The church. But for right now, remember, we're looking at this from Daniel's perspective. He's not in the first century. None of that's happened yet. He's perplexed even by what he's being told. He's asking questions. His questions are being answered. But is he being given a lot of detail? No. They're very simple. So he says, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all of the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured and broke in pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. And about the 10 horns which were on its head, and about the other horn which came up before. Remember, three of them had been ripped off, and where they had ripped off, another horn had grown right there. And he was concerned about this horn, which the three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, and which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints, whoever these saints are. So you start to see the picture. Remember, the picture from Daniel's perspective, but this is apocalyptic. So there's a message for Daniel, and there's a message for us. And in the next chapter, he's going to be told to seal this up because distant future. So this is message for our benefit also. So just keep in mind, who are these saints? They could be different. Two different people. Just one moment again, Judy. So this horn is speaking pompous words, and he was watching this, and it was waging war against the saints and prevailing against them. Now, from our vantage point, and then I'll let Judy ask her question. From our vantage point, we know a war is going on. Who's prevailing? Who's prevailing in the war that's being fought on earth? We're not prevailing. Not at all. Who's in the larger numbers? The world is in the larger numbers. Will we prevail? Yes. God, in both of these visions, the next one and this one, makes it clear that the victory is going to be his. But does he have the victory yet? No. Only part of this is happens. Until that victory happens, until it's deemed the end of time and the kingdom gets returned back to him, this war is going to continue. It started in heaven and it's here on earth, and it's being fought in both places. In fact, at one point when Gabriel's dispatched to Daniel, he'll tell Daniel, I would have been here sooner, but I was fighting this battle. You think Judy had a question first. So anyway, God hasn't prevailed yet. He will prevail, and that's the message. Be faithful unto death. Yes, Judy, what was it? The Most High is the Ancient of Days. Who is the Most High? Who did Nebuchadnezzar call the Most High? God. Daniel, the God Daniel worshipped. And since this is the same time frame, it's easy to put that interpretation. In the New Testament, when you talk about the Most High sovereignty, there is no other. Who's being referred to? God. So the only real question in all of this, whether it be in 18 or 22, is really, who are these saints? Now I'll ask you the question again. Does it matter who the saints are? Whether they're angels, which I don't really... Does it matter whether they're angels or whether they're human from the human realm, or both? No, it really doesn't matter, because what's important to us from our vantage point is the kingdom was established. That part of this vision or dream or prophecy has happened. So it was established. And according to this, it's going to continue forever, but there'll come a point in time when it's deemed that all of the enemies are put under Christ's feet, and the kingdom, he'll hand it back off to God. And in the New Testament, there's various messages from Paul and others that's going to take place at the very end of all time. So you see that in these messages as well. Yes, Scott. Yes. We are in possession of the kingdom, but is there still a battle between the forces of evil and the forces of good going on? This is depicting a time when all of that has come to an end once and for all. And what happens once and for all? The kingdom is returned back to God. It's still going to last forever, but is it going to be in this turmoil? No. It's going to be perpetual peace. That's what we're told in the New Testament. In chapter 8, even this part of it will become a little bit more clear, but we're not in chapter 8, and we're looking at it from Daniel's perspective, and we can see how perplexed he must have been. You know, he's even asking questions of someone who can answer them, and the answers he's getting are vague at best. We can understand it from our vantage point because there's been a lot of history take place between the time of Daniel and 2012 in our era. So we can see in history certain things that fits this pattern and know for sure that there's still some things that haven't happened yet. But it makes more sense to us. What he was trying to tell Daniel, really, and his people here, is that message. You're being oppressed, but it's not going to last forever, and the victory will be mine. And it's the same message as in Revelation 2:10. Be faithful unto death, and I'll reward you. The victory's going to be mine. Evil isn't going to prevail. I'm going to prevail. But that hasn't happened yet. That point in our way of keeping time hasn't happened yet. And Christ says, nobody knows when that point in time is. Who knows? The Father. He's the only one that knows. Even Christ said he didn't know. All right, in verse 22, it says, let's go back to 21 there. I was watching, and that same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints, the Most High. And the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Now, there'll be more said about this in a moment, but even in the first century, partly discussed in the Bible, and certainly in the writers that left writings behind of the first and second century, was there a battle going on where the saints weren't winning? At the hand of who? At the hand of the Roman government. Nero was part of them. Domitian was the worst of all of them. I mean, we hear preachers talking all the time about how Nero did this and Nero did that. He was just a drop in the bucket. There was other Caesars that did far worse for a longer period of time. And it wasn't until Constantine that all of that changed. So anyhow, we can read of early individuals in the church who were put to death for their belief. So the kingdom was established, but there was forces prevailing against it, and the church at that point in time was not winning the battle. The saints weren't winning. You can debate the issue, actually. I could debate it either way, whether we're winning or not winning, even at this point in time. But certainly, we're not in the phase of perpetual peace yet. That's talked about all throughout the New Testament. That hasn't happened yet. The kingdom is ours, but we're still fighting a battle. And we'll fight it right up until the very end of time. From verses 22 through 28 is the interpretation the angel gives of specifically the question Daniel asked about this fourth beast. In the time remaining, I'll read those verses, and I'll leave you with thinking about it. We'll pick up there next week. But what he says here is, remember, he's perplexed again by what he saw and has only been given part of the explanation. So now he's asking about this fourth beast. That was the second question. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all of the other kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth, trample it, break in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings. And oh, by the way, there was ten kings in Rome. I'm throwing that out there too. So anyway, those ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and after shall arise after them. He shall be different, this final one, shall be different from the first one, and shall subdue three of the kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and laws. Then the saints shall be given into his hand, and the for a time, and times, and a half time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. So he didn't discuss this with anybody. But remember, he said at the first part of this chapter, when he had it and it was over, he wrote in summary what he had seen and what he had been told. But he didn't tell anybody about it. And in chapter 8, 3 years have gone by, and God is going to take another tack at this. He's going to deliver the same message, but in a little different way with a little more detail. So think about that this week. Really think about it. We're fortunate enough to live in the time frame that we live in, where we can look back in history and see all these prophecies and see which ones have been fulfilled and which ones have not yet been fulfilled. And it helps us to get a better understanding of what God was trying to tell us. I thought Lalo came in. Oh, he is. Scott, it's you. All right. It's all yours, Scott. Thanks for your thoughts.
Amen. 709, Holy Spirit in the back of your book. Holy Spirit.